This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40, created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. This week's guest is the comedian, writer and all-round screen hogger Sarah Pascoe, host of The Great British Sewing Bee, presenter of Last Woman on Earth and ubiquitous panel show presence. She has written and starred in her own sitcom, Out of Her Mind. And that was before TV realised women could write sitcoms too. She's also the author of two brainy non-fiction bestsellers, Animal and Sex, Love, Money.
Trying to fit in makes you seem so weird. And if you are studying other people to copy, like an anthropologist, and then you get it so wrong.
Sarah came and sat in my kitchen with Sausage the cat, who was still a bit poorly after his encounter with E. coli. Thanks for asking. To talk about her debut novel, Weirdo, the tale of a woman desperate to seem like a normal, whatever that is, well-adjusted grown-up. We talked about everything from cat love, the rhesus monkey theory of motherhood, Happy Valley and her short-lived teenage rebellion, to IVF, the importance of sharing salary information, how she learnt to stop doing things resentfully and why she won't be sad to be done with menstruation. Oh, well, thank you. You're okay with cats, aren't you?
I love cats, yeah.
He's not been very well, so he's a bit sulky. He had E. coli, but I am totally wasting time telling you about my cat's E. coli. Okay.
My husband, annoyingly, is allergic to cats, so we've got a dog, but that's as far as it will ever go until I choose cats over him.
Yeah, well, that could happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. I heard did a whole podcast with Dawn Portra, doing a portrait about that.
Yeah.
Picking cats over your husband.
But, yeah.
So we won't go there.
It would be what is it? It's a consolation prize.
That's what I think. Well, the husband, not the cat.
Yeah, so after, if it's like, oh no, my marriage broke down, but cats.
Yeah, it's fine, you'll get cats.
Yeah. My mum's got 5. Yeah. She got a cat. My mum had never had a pet, and then she'd never looked after a pet. And she loved the cat so much, she then bred the cat and kept all the kittens.
Oh my God.
And that's what she's got now. And she must be 61. But she talks about it. She goes, love is love. And it's like, it's the truest love she's ever known, her cats.
Do you know what? This is really sad. But I really do agree with her, because Sausage has been, he's been really ill. He's a rescue cat and he had an accident. So he's always, his pelvis was crushed and he's got no tail. Oh. And so he's always had a bit of problem down there.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, he got E. coli and it's caused all sorts of problems. And we were told the prognosis was really poor. And he was like,
See, I was a wreck.
Yeah.
It seems to be rallying. Okay. For now.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah. Pets. So we're straight.
I don't think it's weird. I think it's a non-verbal love, which means that it's really tactile and it's really language is the thing that exists above. Well, this is a couple of boyfriends ago, but we had a cat who went missing for 5 days. Oh. And I started dressing as him at gigs. I was dressing in a cat costume, yeah, because I didn't know how to function in my life because I couldn't say to people, you know, I didn't feel like mother, son or anything, but it felt like I had lost someone from my life and worse, they might need me and I couldn't find them and I couldn't help them and I couldn't communicate how much I cared to them. But yeah.
So tell, in that case, then, since we're here, yes. I know you want to talk about it. Yeah. Tell us about the rhesus monkey theory of motherhood because it's mind-blowing.
So the Harry Harlow experiment, when it's described to you, is the most... It's just the darkest, and animal experimentation in general is horrible. And it was sort of behaviorism. But what they wanted to know, and this is back when schizophrenia was blamed on cold mothers. So psychology was blamed on mothers in general. Mothers who weren't nurturing was the worst thing that could happen to a human being. And so they had this, then essentially the experiment, the question was, is it better to have affection or food for children?
Yeah.
And they did this experiment where they had robot wire mothers. And if you ever look at a picture of them, they're so much worse than you even imagine. And one of them was very covered with fur and could give like these mechanical hugs. And the babies were taken straight away from their real mothers. I mean, it's just so barbaric. And there's pictures of them clinging to these soft robots, but being starved. And then the other version is that there's loads of milk. There were nipples on it. They could feed as much as they wanted.
Oh my God,
but they were made of wire
perverse.
And cold. Oh, it's so awful. And then the worst thing, and I couldn't even put this in the book because it's so horrible to write down, but they were then force-bred because they didn't want to breed. The female monkeys who'd been through this, you know, it wasn't, there was no instinct in it. They were force-bred, had children. I don't think it was completely 100% difference, but the difference that they noticed when they had these children was that the ones who'd had affection could sort of mother, but the ones who'd had food and no affection ate the young, was the conclusion. And so then they were like, see, it's mums.
Yeah.
No, if your mum makes you a sandwich but doesn't love you enough, you're going to have problems. There's another one with rhesus monkeys, which is really upsetting.
I love how nerdy you are.
Thank you. There's one where, and it's really horrible, but it basically shows that they will share food if each other are starving, even if they're starving. That they have this empathy with the monkey in the next cage, whereas some ape species don't do that. They look after themselves. God. And rhesus are like shoving grapes underneath to share.
Poor little monkeys.
I know, poor little monkeys. And also, but just who decides to do the experiments? Who thinks that's useful to us? Who's extrapolating? That's what I really hate about it.
Really. And you can imagine the way you've used it in the book. You can, I mean, imagine like either overhearing someone saying that you're the rhesus monkey mother.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Well, teenage girls.
Yeah, teenage girls are brutal.
Brutal. And I think really my sister has a 12-year-old, so not quite a teenager, but they see the world very black and whitely. I really admire it in many, many ways because I think there's an ardentness to a teenage girl that actually really softens through life as you realise everyone is sort of trying and everyone is pretty flawed. But a teenage girl see everyone else as flawed except them.
Yeah.
And especially their mothers.
Yeah. What kind of teenager are you?
I was lucky. Oh, I was lucky. I had a very, very quick rebellion. And then because I felt so guilty about it, it was then over at 14. So my mum always says, like, compared to my sisters, so I had a party when my mum was out of the house. I was persuaded to have a party by a girl at school. And
were you trying to fit in?
Yes. I was trying to be popular. I was trying to kiss a boy, actually. Worse than that. I didn't kiss a boy until I was 16, so it didn't work. For anyone listening, thinking about, but a girl at school had persuaded me that boys would come to this party and it would be at my house, you know, and I'm suddenly the centre of the hub. And I was manipulated. And actually I had that sick feeling the entire time. I knew it was wrong and I knew it wasn't going to work, but it had gone too far.
Mm.
And people brought alcohol and they brought drugs to my house and the police were called and the neighbours were angry.
Oh my God.
And so it was incredibly stressful. And I stayed up all night trying to clean up and the house was full of smoke. And
was your mum still out?
Yeah, she'd gone out for one night with a boyfriend. So it wasn't that she was on holiday and I had weeks to, and then they came home and I begged her to hit me. I said, please hit me, because I just wanted to feel better. And if she'd have slapped me around the face, I could have gone, right, okay, now we're even. And she refused. But it did, from instantly then, it's like I'd done the worst thing. And yeah, I was actually quite well behaved after that, at least to her. Yeah.
But it's that brutal school thing, isn't it? If you're the slightly, either like the slight aptly, the outsider, or actually they think you're a total weirdo.
Yeah. I think it's the really hard. Trying to fit in makes you seem so weird. Mm. And if you are studying other people to copy, an anthropologist. Yeah. And then you get it so wrong. I once stole some money from my mum to buy a pair of boots. And because me, Cheryl had the same. I think she's not as badly as me, but we both used to wear my mum's clothes.
And Cheryl, your sister.
Yeah, my middle one. So we were at the same school, and at school discos. So on non-uniform days, we both wore Manchester United kits head to toe. We did not understand why that was a problem.
You did support Manchester United.
We did support Manchester United. Yes. And we thought it was amazing that we had these football kits, and we didn't. So we didn't know how that was wrong. And we both used to wear my mum's clothes to school discos, because we thought my mum was so beautiful and her clothes were so lovely. So these were like gold lamé suits from Next.
And you were what, that 13, 14,
yes,
15?
Yeah. And also, yeah, I stole money from my mum once to buy a pair of boots I'd seen in a shop. And because I thought these boots were the answer, if I wore them to school, because everyone at school had money and we didn't have money, but these boots were going to transcend that and everyone would go, oh my God. So in my head, this is like, I wouldn't have known any shoe brands, but these are like Miu Miu or Manolo or something.
Yeah, they might have been Gucci, yes, or something, as far as you were concerned.
Yes, but they were £30, black boots, they were not, and they had massive gold buckles on the front. That was what I thought made them look really like rich.
Yeah.
And wearing them through the school gates, bearing in mind I'd stolen, hidden them in my bag, put them on to, and like, this is when my life was going to change, you know, and people instantly being like, what the fuck is she wearing?
Yeah, what's she got on her
She's
feet?
Got these like puss in boots, massive black boots with gold buckles. And then realizing, how'd I get it wrong again? How did I get it so wrong?
It's the trying, isn't it? I mean, I was definitely that kid, and I remember about 13 thinking that if I wore tights and heels to school, I would somehow be cooler, or yeah. I only did it once. Just made everything worse.
I once gave myself love bites down my arms because it's the only place I could reach.
I bet there's not a teenager who hasn't done that.
Yeah, exactly. But that's it. That's the logic, isn't it? And it's not something where you feel safe enough. I'm sure there are people that do have adults in their life where you can say to an adult, like, there's a girl called Alison in my class, and she's snogging a boy, and she's got like love bites on her neck, and it seems like a badge of honour.
Yeah.
And I want to be like the other girls. I want to be involved in this conversation. So I'm going to suck my own arms and then go in and pretend I met someone.
So they think I've got a boyfriend who's into arms.
Yeah. So I've been snogging.
I think people must have parents like that now that they can talk to about that. But I just think it was always like, the message I got was always, sorry, mum, because you will listen, is that love bites look cheap.
Of course, because they have had a whole life since school. I think that's it. Is it what seems really, really massive to you at 13, 14, 15? You explain to an adult and it is funny to them.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what's really disappointing about confessing any of it to an adult, is what they say is, you won't care about this person one day. Life is so long.
But you don't care, do you? Right now, you don't care. You just want to fit in.
I remember being told while at school that school wasn't important. And I would think, but why are you making me go? Yeah, why are you making me go? It's my entire life. And you're dismissing it and saying, by the time you're at university, you'll never even think about it, which isn't true because I talk about it constantly.
Did you, I mean, I think that one of the things is, it feels like there's a space for blokes to be weird. Like that there's like there's a whole Hollywood strand of weirdness for men, like the geek gets the girl and, you know, God knows they own all our personal data now. But like being a weird girl, it's not a path for that.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because Carrie and I have started a podcast, which is, and essentially it's a book podcast, but what we're really interested in is books that are about outsiders, books that make you feel better about yourself.
Mm.
And unfortunately, we are really struggling to find male authors, because we're finding so many women authors do write about weird women.
Is that a recent-ish thing?
I've got no idea. And it might just be that I'm, you know, they say that, you know, everyone's very homosexual in their reading choices. It might just be that we keep finding women writers writing about women that we love. But all, I think that there's, and also we have this theory, or I had this theory, you know, Claire Dedham has just written this book about monsters.
Oh, I love that book. Yeah. I love it.
I think weirdos are unconfident monsters, and monsters are just confident weirdos. And that's where there might be a gender thing involved.
Yes.
I think that weirdos...
The confidence of the mediocre man. Yes. So the confidence of the brilliant man is like, whoa.
Yes, exactly.
When you were a teenager, I suppose what I'm thinking is, when did you get confident in yourself? When did you decide who you were, decide what your personality was?
I think, like lots of comedians, I have a seesaw between overconfidence and insecurity. It's a really common thing with comics. And I describe it like a seesaw because it's not necessarily an enjoyable, constant. It's not the kind of piece of self-belief that you would want in the creative fields. It's, oh my God, I hate everyone. Why have I lost this competition? I'm the best. Why does no one respect me? And then absolutely, I'm not good enough to do this. How dare I stand with a microphone being the loudest person in the room? Who am I? Who would want to listen to me?
Loads of people, obviously.
Yeah. Or sometimes yes, sometimes no. And then there's a middle ground. Yeah, you can't please everyone, but some people want what you're serving. You know, there is a middle ground, but sort of vacillating. I think my current show is oddly about something that happened when I was 14 and I auditioned for Michael Barrymore to go on his reality show. Barrymore's My Kind of People.
Your current show is about success,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. But what oddly really happened when I was 40... all this years later from 14 is realizing that that person I was at 14, everything I didn't like about her, which was that I went on stage and I burst into tears basically. And on the way out of the shopping center, people said to me that I'd been brave to get up there. And I only heard that 22 years later.
That's so interesting.
22 years later, I heard what people had said. They had said things like, well done for giving it a go. And suddenly all this time later, I thought that part of my personality, which I don't value or haven't valued, is the reason I have my job. That part, the chutzpah, the part that doesn't think, that goes, no, I just want everyone to look at me, whether I'm prepared or not, that kind of feeling. For the first time, I valued it at 40. And I realized that had been an engine that had kept, that had got me my job that I'm really grateful for and I really love. And it finally made sense to me.
That's what happened at 40 that made you think that?
I did another singing competition on television. I did a audition and Jerry Halliwell. It was so stupid. It was so stupid. My agent sent me this. It was a Christmas special of a singing competition on BBC One. And she said, these kind of things are really tacky. You know, it's Gemma Collins and some people from Love Island are on it and some sort of like retired rugby players. And I said to her, you know, I don't talk about this, but when I was 14, I tried to sing on TV. And I said, for my teenage self, well, she knew one day I was going to be on this kind of show and meet Jerry Halliwell. And it was for me, it was like, this is the end of my movie. This is the thing that makes everything make sense.
Yeah,
and
then, you were like completing the narrative arc.
Yes, completing the narrative arc, apart from exactly the same thing happened, which was it became far too nerve-wracking. I kept thinking too much about being a teenager and my throat closed up before I started singing and it just sounded terrible. And it sounded terrible, and which would have been fine if I'd been there as a comic to just have fun. But I was there to show off and be a good singer.
For you, it was more serious.
It was really serious. And then Jerry Halliwell told me I was out of tune. And I had to, and I was really aware of like, oh, it's so different crying at 14. I am now, you know, almost 40, about to cry on national television. I mean, here as a comic, no one thinks I'm there to sort of... to sing prettily for
they
my
think
teenage
it's okay
self.
To be funny.
Well, I should. You're supposed to be funny. You're supposed to be bad at things and then funny about it. That's why they book you.
Yeah.
And I was just too earnest, and I'd built it up so much in my head. And it was that. That's what I realized. I was like, why have I made the same mistake again? Why did it matter so much? Why did I put myself in that position? Because my agent had said to me, don't do it. And on the train home, I remember I bought a baguette from Manchester Pret. And I thought, this isn't taking the pain away. And I called her and she said, I did tell you not to do it. She said, this is the kind of thing that happens.
You just thought it'd be a laugh.
Yeah. I said, they were so mean to me. They were so mean. She said, that's the show. Yeah, you're being judged on singing. I said, I don't want to be judged.
Would you do Strictly?
I got asked to do Strictly a couple of years ago. So it's the first time I've got asked. I've always wanted to do it in that way of...
Yeah, it's the one thing that I think I'd like to do, yes. But I know I wouldn't even last. I'd be first off. No,
that's
question.
It. You have to sort of delude yourself that you're one of the ones where they go, oh my God, you're a natural dancer. Yeah, no, I know. And I'm not a natural dancer. Once I had a DJ in the nightclub turn the music off to make fun of me. He said I was like something out of Jurassic Park. So, and I'm hearing myself say that.
How old were you then?
I was a teenager.
Yeah. But yeah. Oh, I thought you said 36.
No, I was 16 at Hollywood's in Montford. But I need to hear myself say that and go, it's not some magic where you've been hiding dancing talent your entire life. It would be quick, and again, it would be judgment. But when I was first doing IVF, they had a meeting, and it was actually odd because I was having Zoom therapy with my therapist, who was specialised in fertility and miscarriage. And as she was talking, a text came up from my agent on my phone, which said, strictly want a meeting. And then I was just sort of like, and I said, and it was actually great that it happened during therapy, because I said to her, this is a prime example. I said, because my entire journey with infertility, I always kept telling myself it was fine because now I could do that job. No, it's fine. It hasn't worked. I can do that job now. Or, you know, actually what's really good is I can do this work because, you know, this isn't working. And it was a prime just about to start IVF. And I thought, I can't be going to IVF hoping it's not going to work so that I can do strictly.
No, no. And it was, no, that'd be too much of a head fuck.
Yeah, too much of a head fuck. But I did the meeting with Strictly because I wanted to know what it was like and what they asked about. Because I'm so fascinated in the process. Because I had
signed an NDA.
I haven't signed an NDA.
What did they ask?
They're trying to assess your personality. They're trying to assess who... positivity, I guess, that you're going to come out every week and have a good positive attitude to dancing.
Yeah, and how bouncing back you
are. Yes, bouncing back, that you do care, that you'd be there for the right reasons.
Mm. That you can cope with Craig telling you your shit every week.
Yes, but also press intervention. They do also have to sort of work out what skeletons you have in your closet, and they need to know them first because they can protect you if they know.
Cool.
Because you suddenly become of interest to... I guess the Sun newspaper,
you haven't ever been interested. Yeah. A personality rather than your job. But that must have already happened to you a bit with Sewing Bee.
Not really.
I mean, it's not as big as Strictly, but it's still, you're on primetime telly.
Yes. But I don't think in the same way where it would be a big splash, whereas Strictly, anything they can find on you, I think would be they could sell. And make it news. Sewing Bee, I think, is much more. I mean, it's much more about the sewers, which is a nice thing.
Is there anything they could have found about you that you haven't already mined in your comedy?
No, but what my worry for Strictly was I've talked about sex too much, and it's a family show. And if you go on YouTube, because I said to them, and they said, oh no, we've had Chris Ramsey, we've had comedians before. The members of the and obviously they've been through it. Members of the public understand that comics talk about very adult content.
Yeah.
And it's not the program's fault if they employ people who've talked about adult things. Yeah. So they've they've been through it before. Yeah.
So I think it would have been just too weird to have been doing IVF and hoping it didn't work so you could.
Yeah. So,
instead I had to do a samba with.
Yes.
I don't know.
I know. Johannes. I know. So instead So instead I had to do the opposite. I did ask, I said, if IVF works, I would be 4 months pregnant. And they said, yeah, you can't. Strictly.
No, we can't take responsibility.
No, we can't whiz you around in a wheelchair to keep you safe.
Insurance wouldn't.
Exactly.
Cover I know. That.
Yeah, there's no comfortableness of that. And also, if you have a dancing history, it's fine to keep dancing, but you can't start a new hobby early pregnancy.
No, like really intense exercise. So you had reconciled yourself, hadn't you, to not having children?
Yes.
As I had.
Yeah. 40 was my cutoff. When I read Sheila Hetty's book, which I think was about 37, I loved the whole just having a line where you decide, okay, that's it. Mm. And I transitioning from might not have children to didn't have children and the relief of that.
Yeah, totally. And the relief of that, because I was thinking that you actually did IVF at the point everybody stops asking you when you're going to have children.
Yeah.
So at the point you would have been free of the pressure to do it. What made what made the change?
Well, what made me is my husband. And I don't want to make it sound like it was really patriarchal. Two things. If COVID hadn't happened, so I had like lots of people who, especially lots of people who work freelance, I had a year's work cancelled in two phone calls.
Yeah.
I was in Finland. We were halfway through a job. One phone call said, this isn't happening. And that was like, oh my God. And especially because we'd been out of the country, we didn't know how bad it was. I'd been out of the country for 12 days. And in those 12 days, it was the days where people were stockpiling toilet paper and buying pasta.
It was so weird.
And we were in a country that had like 3 cases of COVID. So it was very, very different.
But it still felt like an exaggeration even then, though.
So that's it. So when we got back to Heathrow, which was on a plane, so we were told to leave Finland. They said they're closing the borders. And this all now felt like a drama. And then got to Heathrow and there was nothing in the M&S. And that's when it was hitting us. Like, what has happened here?
Yeah.
Like, what has happened?
Like being a disaster movie.
Yeah. It's odd, isn't it? And that's so recent. And we're still processing it. Or just the fact that that's what can happen to you. So the big thing was I lost all my work. And I didn't flourish in those conditions.
Other comedians wrote books.
I know. I honestly have a theory that anyone who was, and I'm sorry if this is you, anyone who was able to creatively flourish in that situation is a bit psychopathic.
Yeah, though I was hopeless.
It was miserable. It was miserable inside. Yeah. And that was a collective communal misery.
Those people who just went, oh yeah, well, I know I work from home anyway, so I just carried on. It's like, who even are you?
No. Yeah, we did nothing. I mean, we were at home. I didn't write anything.
So you decide to have loads of sex and loads of hormones.
That's enormous. What happened was we had really big conversations where I said basically I couldn't do it anymore. The cycle of every month thinking I could be, living half of the month, but am I? And is this? And, you know, I actually think you can imagine so much is happening in your body. Or just the hormones of being due on is so similar to what you can Google as early pregnancy, very cruelly. And my husband said, can we really, really try? And I'd been really... The medical side of things just really intimidated me and I was embarrassed. And I also had sort of very working class attitudes of like, I don't think you should spend money trying to have children when there's already children existing.
Yes,
I had attitudes like that. Yeah. There's a lot of overcoming. And my husband just said, look, you've always said 40 is your cutoff. Can, because he's younger than me. He said, can you give me 2 more years? And we just really try. And if I hadn't had such an empty diary, a completely empty diary. Yeah, yeah. And I did also understand his point.
The hormones mess you around, don't they?
Someone gave me quite good advice about the hormones, which was that the ones for sort of the, this is not me saying it would be this for everyone, but the ones in terms of like growing the eggs are the hormones from the early part of your cycle. So if in your early cycle you feel okay, and then after ovulation you crash, which is what I would experience, they said you might be all right. And it was good because then I wasn't thinking, oh, these injections are going to make me go crazy.
Yeah.
I kept remembering this is early cycle. You're getting a lot of the early cycle. It's just very, very emotional. But the other side of it is having been, you know, we'd been trying for 5 years, it also felt like actively doing something.
Yeah.
Rather than just waiting and hoping.
Yeah.
It felt like, okay, this is us really trying. And then because it worked and we got pregnant and stayed pregnant, now I'm just evangelical about it. And I love talking to other people who are going through it because there is this chance. And especially as 40 was my cutoff, how strange to have had a son at 40. And then because we had frozen embryos, to try again and now to be having another son at 42.
So this pregnancy is from the same...
Yes, they're twins technically, which
amazing,
is magic.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Twins, but 2 years younger.
Yeah. It's amazing that they can keep it in a freezer, 5 days old. And then it's absolutely, all of it is existential.
How's it changed you? How's it changed your approach to work, life?
I think it hasn't changed me, but my life is complete drudgery. My favourite thing to say around the house is, I used to be someone.
I used to be Sarah Pascoe.
I used to be someone, okay? I used to not be wearing pyjamas. It's drudgery. Lots of very, very boring housework and a constant Sisyphean cycle of they nap. You very, very as quickly as you can tidy up and then they mess it all up again.
Just over and over.
Constant.
Has it affected your husband's work?
So this year, he went away for 4.5 months. I don't think he enjoyed, I don't think he knew how hard it was going to be.
Mm.
And it was a work offer that was so huge, there was no way either of us. I think if I had said to him, no, you can't go, that would actually have been the end of us as a relationship.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Too big an opportunity.
Too big an opportunity. And also when you don't take those big opportunities, my husband's 36. Relatively early in his career, you spend the rest of your career wondering what happened if you'd done that job. Whereas he did get to do the job and he will always know.
Yeah.
And he will always know. And we will always know how hard it was. And I know that there are single parents, but it was horrific being pregnant with a toddler. My toddler's very energetic and it's been constant. And he doesn't sleep. So
great.
Yes. So it's a recipe for misery. But I did keep thinking to myself, I wouldn't rather be in Australia filming, not seeing him for months. That isn't.
Yeah.
So I did keep reminding myself, this is awful, but this is a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what does success look like to you now?
I think success might look and feel a lot like boredom. I think the spikes necessitate crash. So probably what we don't think of as success or appreciate as success, you know, like when you get sick or someone you love gets sick and you suddenly go, all those years of health, appreciating, not being grateful for it. I think there's a similar thing going on. Being alive itself, being alive without huge worries, especially not financial worries or health worries. Mm. Actually, I think that probably is as good as it gets. But, you know, we're hungry dopamine creatures who want something a bit more. But I think every time you do get a bit more, there will be a balance. A whoop, it gets taken away again.
And you do get hooked. I mean, it's definitely true. You do get hooked on the highs, the kind of like the on stage moment. But I think that's probably one of the best descriptions I've heard of it, because of that reaching that point where I would rather be happy, not happy, but just like what I do. Do it well and not have those kind of, I don't know, the highs and the lows. And I don't know whether it's an age thing, whether it's too many low, you have enough low.
Realizing that there's always going to be a price for it afterwards. Mm. But really with stand-up, and I think I'm now finding this with writing, the really, 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 really enjoyable bit is the new idea, the hope at the beginning of a process. And the bit that's a struggle is that it's finished and you can't change it. And now it gets judged.
Yeah. But one thing that I really loved about it, and it's actually not just Weirdo, but it's about your work really, is that you do kind of, it's not like you don't go there in terms of, I'm going to make this really rude and make everybody go, oh, that's excruciating. You just tell the truth. I've really been trying to remember. Do you think I've ever read a book where a woman has changed a tampon? Or that real honesty about sometimes sex is boring, sometimes it's painful, sometimes you forget to be in the moment, you suddenly realise you've been writing a shopping list.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything, but that's the truth.
Yes. There's things, this is very precocious, but when I was at university and we were studying Samuel Beckett, and it was like Samuel Beckett was the first person to have a character do a wee, and then James Joyce was the first writer to have a character do a poo. And I thought, well, where are all the periods then? And I know it has got much, much better. I've noticed massive things in recent novel writing. Number one, not assuming everyone in a novel is white. white writers have got much, much better at signalling from surnames and descriptions. It's like, don't just assume the entire world is white, because we did for a really long time.
Yeah.
And toilet habits, periods. What I wanted was that her menstrual cycle, I needed her moods to be like someone who has bad PMT.
Yeah.
I needed to know when she was ovulating. Yeah. And she was going to be sort of just slightly calmer.
Go through her cycles with her. And I think that's one of the things that people talk about it, but they don't actually demonstrate it.
Yeah.
So you might, somebody in a book, I mean, there's so much, like, I know it's been called Sad Girl Lit, but there are so many of those books, and it's like basically, oh, I've got PMS. It's not just like being in the PMS, which is.
Now, the other thing is the financial thing that I was reading. Oh, you know, you read lots and lots of books, and it's so rare that money actually exists. People just get what they want to. You know, if they want to travel somewhere, they just get on a train. They never have to weigh up how much the train ticket is. And as someone who, for the majority of my life, would have had to check how much was on my Oyster card, I kept thinking, well, where's all the actual real people where money is constant? Economics is constant maths of, can I do that? Do I need to go home? Can I buy this round?
Yeah, and I can't afford to leave because I've got nowhere to go and I've got loads of debt.
But it forces story, doesn't it? There's a point where Sophie can't get an Uber home. And so, the story is moved by that. Yeah, it can be an influence,
It's like that classic, and I want to say ITV drama, but isn't it just ITV? Because I was watching a BBC One earlier this week where the lead female character who... No, one of the female characters was a police officer, of course, because that's all I watch.
Yeah.
She lived in this like palatial Georgian house. And obviously her kitchen had a kitchen island the size of this room and those great big crittle, when, you know, all along the back of the house. And I just thought, she's a moderately senior police officer. Mm. She must come from money.
Yes.
They always.
And they don't justify
default,
it.
I find often when this podcast, women are really, really reluctant to talk about money.
Oh, I like talking about money. Because I think otherwise you're gaslighting. When I was poor, and I was poor for a long time, you know, after university, I did have debt, university debt, which then escalated because I didn't understand they would start charging interest. When I left university, I was very ignorant of lots of things. Anyway, all I wanted was rich people to admit or tell me what it was like. And instead what I got is people saying, you know, money can't buy you happiness. But, well, it buys you a lot of things.
Yeah, it can't buy you happiness, but only people with money say that.
Yeah, and also, if you could wipe out your debt, if you don't have debt, to me, that would have been happiness. There's this cloud that sits around you, constant sort of worrying and all these kind of things. And so I wanted to know. And so I'm quite gross with money. But then also it's quite good with comedy and with women. Because I've had other experiences where people tell you what they're getting for something, which means you can negotiate better. Or
do you find did you used to find you got paid less than men?
Not necessarily. There are situations where some men or their representation are really good at fighting for things, but some of those men are now really good at telling you what they're on. There's been situations, I don't want to necessarily name the men because I haven't given permission, but they'll do the opposite. They'll check what you're on to check you're on the same as them.
Oh, which is really
good because they know the same thing's going on. And there's certain situations where I was asking for more money from a TV channel for hosting because the money was relatively low. And they used an example of a man on another channel getting less than me, going, well, he's only on this and they're on their third series. And I thought, you know, I need to tell that man that not only is he's being underpaid, he's being used as an example by other production companies because people know that his wage is low. And I've had a situation where, you know, we were on a series and everyone had a little bump up, you know, say at £500 up. We'd all gone up very apart from one whose agent had just signed the contract. And I thought, oh God, you know, it's so political, but I'm going to have to tell him, just so you know, your agent has to negotiate. Everyone else got their money up this series and your agent just signed off. And he's like, well, we're just so happy. I said, I know you are, it's the principle of it. I don't want to create issues. It doesn't create an issue if you just get a bump up with everyone else. That's fair.
Yeah. You're not demanding to be paid twice as much because you think you're funnier.
No, it's not an ego thing. It's not an ego thing. And as is happening with the strikes in America, is these are the people who have the money. Of course, the human thing is you go, but it's ridiculous to get paid that amount for a day's work. And so you can understand why people do shrug and go, well, you know, we would do this for free. Aren't we lucky? But at the same time, yes, but it's a business.
But it's only creative work where you're ever expected to do it for free because you're so lucky.
Yeah.
You know, you would never, I know this is a really hackneyed example, but no one would ever say it to a plumber or an electrician or my dad's a bricklayer. He would never have laid a brick for free. He would just thought you were having a laugh.
No one would ever contact you and go, it's really good for your profile if you come and build this wall.
Come and build me a house that will look great on your CV.
When I get asked to do things for free, especially if it's because small organizations or like universities and things, I say to them how unhelpful it is, especially when it's a feminist event, which is what I would normally be asked to do, to have an expectation that the two things go hand in hand, that we're so desperate to talk about feminism that you don't have to ask your university for a budget for it. I said, really get into the habit of paying women. Like, that's a really huge thing in general.
That kind of the number of, I don't get asked it anymore because I always said, pay me and I'll do it.
But that's
a scary thing. As a woman and a freelance, so you say, I will only do it if you pay me properly, and this is my flat rate, or like all those International Women's Day events where they don't pay.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, wow, International Women's Day for free.
Yes. I always say to them, you can say to people, you can donate your feedback, you know, all of these kind of things. But yeah, really get in the habit of, if your event isn't actually making money, then should you be doing the event? Should everyone be giving up an evening? For what purpose?
Yeah.
With comedy nights, it's quite often that. It's like, well, we might break even. Why are we doing it? Because it's not helping international women.
No. Do you feel like you could say that now from where you're standing, though? And when would young Sarah would have totally done it?
What I've done is a lot of things resentfully. And what I now know is that it's not good for them, and it's especially not good for you. When you say yes to something, you know, it's 6 months off. And then on the day, you're going, why have I agreed to this? I hate this. I don't want to do it. Maria Bamford has a routine in her last stand-up show, which is about when you get asked to do something you don't want to do. She was asked to go back to her old university and talk to the students, and they offered her no money. And a lawyer, an accountant friend of hers said, always quote an exorbitant fee. And then she said, why? I said, because either they'll say no, they can't afford you, or they'll pay you it.
That's exactly what my agent said. I was asked to do something. I was like, it was host a day for a corporate business. She was like, have you got a going rate? And I was like, I literally have no idea. And also no interest. And she was like, look, okay, I'm going to ask for 10 grand.
Yeah.
Either they'll pay it and you'll be a lot richer and so will I, or they won't and you won't care. So
exactly.
I had a boss once who said to me, you're a rubbish negotiator because you always care too much. And the person who wins the negotiation is the person who's prepared to pull the trigger. And I thought, I hate you for saying that, but I really hate you because you're right.
Yeah. If you don't care that the job's going to walk away and go to someone who will do it for £2,000. You didn't want to do it. Yeah. So you're in a position of strength. I think, I hate things being along gender lines, but I think there's also, I think men have quite a lot of fun negotiating with money.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of a game and we can have fun with it too.
Yeah. It's that kind of so much power in economic power. And I mean, it seems really simplistic to say women aren't taught it. But it feels like we are.
But it's really recent that women weren't earning money.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really recent that it's within a century that, you know, the male wage was really high because men supported their entire families. Dads supported their daughters, then gave them away at marriage to another family who now would financially support her. So, of course, we're learning this for the first time. And yeah, because it was then stepped in, you know, after the Second World War, women were on such low wages compared to men.
And then they were forced back in the house because the 50s happened.
Yeah, because it's threatened and what we did to the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what ironically, I know the American laws better than the British laws because it's something I'm writing. But, you know, you couldn't get a bank account in America without your husband or father's signature until 1975.
You couldn't rent here. And my granddad left his first wife. She had a daughter and he abandoned them. And I know this from her daughter, who's my mum's half-sister. She's got her mum's diaries, which is she couldn't rent a property after he abandoned her. Her parents had to rent a property for her.
It's horrific, isn't it?
Well, the dependence, it is horrific. And I think this is where women we can forgive ourselves a little bit, is that isn't a long time ago. It wasn't like people
were
telling
us. Centuries.
This is a new conversation. And if people feel reticent or it's unladylike or being given a certain message by society, like, you're not mad, you are being given that message.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good point. Give ourselves a break.
Yeah, give ourselves a break. I mean, I get very excited in supermarkets. I think supermarkets are my favourite place. I always have a very boring life, but it's because I can buy anything. And I couldn't for years and years and years.
Yeah.
The idea that, I've had little things that with having childcare, actually, I'm now meeting younger people who are in a very different financial situation because they earn an amount per hour and maybe some weeks look very different to others. And I'm now conscious in the shops of how I put things through, especially if my son's grabbed a packet of biscuits and I don't look at the price of the packet of biscuits and it beeps through and it's £6. I've had a thing where I've felt someone else looking at that price thinking, £6 doesn't matter to you. For a packet of biscuits, your son won't eat, that he's going to throw on the floor and you're going to just... So I'm not forgetting. I'm trying to sort of keep a leg in both places where money has a value, but the thing that you get when you... There was a point with stand-up where I was earning a kind of money where it wasn't just, I can survive this month or the next couple of months. It was like, I can probably survive a year without working. I could probably still pay my rent. And then as that elongated into, I won't have to get a proper job, the freedom, the fact that I feel like I have choices, that's what you don't have when you don't have money.
Yeah, you know, you've no choice.
No, and that's what people don't tell you. And you can feel it, that it's true. But conversely, I do believe people make incredible works of creativity, even when they have financial constraints and proper jobs and no time.
Yes, yeah, totally.
Because I think that thing of having 40 minutes on your commute and that's when you write your novel doesn't mean your novel won't be better than someone who, you know, hires a country house and has a view. I think you can create incredible work. In adversity, it's just also, you know, not fun for you.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
What do you think about the way the representation of older women has changed or not in TV, but in comedy?
There's been a lack of representation. So it's not like there's been a good representation or a negative representation. What there's been is a space. Women are, you know, it's like that brilliant Amy Poehler sketch about, you know, your last fuckable day.
Oh, it's so brilliant, isn't it?
So brilliant because it was so true. But like, yeah, women exist, you know, fertile, attractive, won't talk to me, this, but always in relation to how straight men feel about them.
Yeah.
And then they just... Then they quietly go away.
Go away, and then they might come back as a granny.
Yeah.
If they're lucky.
But again, then it's still about nurturing and providing. They still have a role that's about the straight men. Women are creating a lot more work. They're being facilitated. Platforms should create a lot more work, which means that we are much more interested. Women have been like so thirsty for women's stories. I think why podcasting is so exciting. I remember the very first podcast I started listening to, which is called My Favourite Murder, and it's two... It's Karen and Georgia talking to each other. And I was getting, and bear in mind, it's about murder.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, why am I so fizzy whenever I listen to them? And I realised it's because I don't get to hear women talking to each other uninterrupted.
Yeah.
And I do work with women, but never uninterrupted and never just women without that being a huge, big deal, an International Women's Day event. It needs one day a year.
It's a women thing.
Yes, it's a women thing. Yeah. So men didn't want to come. Women are so thirsty for women's stories. And I think, obviously, it's capitalism with writing. And I'm sure there were moments before this, but Kathleen Moran wrote a book that was sort of, you know, aimed at women, about women. And women and men, but really loved it. And then they were like, oh, what?
Oh, shit.
Are women going to buy books or something?
Yeah.
Women were like, oh, just talking to each other. And so I feel like there's the same thing. So I'm 42 now, you know, so I'm getting older and I'm becoming much more interested in stories that reflect my experience or other experiences. And yeah, and that seems to be what's happening when women are making the work. Like Bridget Christie just had a very successful...
Yeah, I just think the change couldn't have happened. Bridget's thing couldn't have happened 3 years ago.
Well, she says I went to her launch where they showed the first three episodes and she said, I couldn't have made this at any other time in my life and it couldn't have existed at any other time. It was just absolutely right now. There's lots of conversation about it, but a conversation, which is a lot of like, why hasn't there been conversation? Mm. But it's funny because the last time I was in Edinburgh for the book event, there was a woman in the Q&A who was upset with me. And this is when I was promoting my first book. And she...
Was that animal?
Yeah. So she said the question before had been about period tracking apps. And I don't think I'd even been on one at the time, but a young woman was asking me what I thought about period tracking apps. We had a conversation and then this woman stood up and she was so upset with me. She said, you don't understand. You don't understand things that they were held against us for decades. And we had to pretend, we had to hide everything to be treated with respect. She said, your generation, you young women, they're going to use this against you. They're going to say you're mad. They're going to say you can't govern. They're going to say all these things because you talk about your hormones in this way. And she was so upset. And it was everyone in the room was so uncomfortable because no one wanted to diminish her experience, her lived experience of being told explicitly and implicitly that she was lesser because she menstruated. But at the same time, that wasn't right. And it wasn't right for women to be quiet. It wasn't okay what happened to her, but it's also not, don't tell young women that they shouldn't talk about it because they won't be respected.
I totally get where she's coming from, because I remember the first time on the pool we did, Anne Friedman wrote it, and it was a long read about periods. It was like, I was mid-40s, and I had spent my entire career shoving my tampon up my sleeve.
Yeah.
And never constantly worried about bleeding through, you know, all of those things. But, you know, you kind of, if you started work in the 80s or arguably early 90s, whole 90s, you had to not exactly pretend to be a man, but downplay.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, she's obviously on this month. Yeah. So to then go into, which is amazing, people saying, yeah, I've got PMS, or I need to work from home 2 days a month because I've got endometriosis, or whatever. That's like a massive shift, but it's a good shift.
Really good shift.
It's not, like you say, it's not saying you didn't have your experience.
Mm.
It's just saying, we're not prepared to put up with it. Because for me, it was working with those women who were not prepared to put up with any of that shit that made me write the shift and start the podcast, because I was like, those women will not go quietly into menopause.
Yeah.
So why the hell should I?
Yeah.
It's a good change.
It is a good change. But there's still a lot of fear, because the narrative that you fight for all those things and you still lose.
Yeah.
That you might be giving them weapons. Yeah, you're weaponizing them. Or the other thing is that they've improved, when I say they, the same misogynists.
Yeah.
They've improved publicly, like racists have.
Yeah.
But they're still there.
Yeah.
And they're better now because they've got... We've given them a language. They can say the right words. They can do the right things. And there are people who don't. There are male people who don't really properly empathize with women as human beings.
No, totally. And it's those.
And then they now hide still very powerfully, still very well. Mm. There's I think there was something, you know, people talk about, like the relief of Donald Trump at least being so obvious.
Yeah.
They were like, there's so many more like him inside their heads.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's never explicitly saying it. Yeah.
It's the whole, nothing makes me more angry than as a father of daughters.
Yeah.
Because I just think you...
It's insidious, isn't it?
You had absolutely fuck all respect for women until you were involved in the breeding of one.
But I still don't think it's respect of women. I think it's ownership of women.
Yes.
It's because it doesn't feel like, oh my gosh, becoming a dad... Oh God, you're people. You've been people this entire time. It's not. It's like, now that I'm defending my genes, I'll decide who. There was this really unhealthy thing when I was growing up, and obviously I didn't have a dad who was like this, which is maybe why I noticed it so much, which was boys being scared of going home to meet dads. That felt like so creepy. Like, what the fuck's it got to do with him?
Oh, well, it's the whole getting permission to ask someone to,
And that game of, like, I guess charming each other, and then and people saying, oh, the dads that are strictest are the ones who are the worst, because they always project what they're thinking in their heads.
What
they wanted to do. They're projecting that onto other young men.
Ugh, yes. So creepy.
It's so creepy. And it's, and obviously still, all still going on. But in terms of women's stories and women's stories that don't involve women not being subsidiary characters, we just love them, don't we? I mean, they're just... And sometimes you're halfway through something before you realise, why do I love this so much? Why am I enjoying it so much? Yeah.
Because it's a woman's story.
Happy Valley would be a prime example for that.
I love that so
much. And every moment, and I kept, the last season, I kept worrying because I loved it so much. And sometimes, especially with the procedural, they have to, plot-wise, just, boom, boom, tighten up her. And it just never, ever did. She never, ever did anything.
She's so amazing.
So amazing.
Sally
Wainwright, and then to have those performers performing her words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Sarah Lancashire's an incredible actor, isn't she?
Yeah, really incredible.
I feel really weird asking someone who sat here 8 months pregnant about menopause.
Oh, yes. Okay.
But how are you feeling about it?
How do I feel about menopause? I would have my entire life told you I'm looking forward to it because I've hated having periods so much.
Oh, yeah. When people say to me, oh, I really miss periods, I think,
yeah.
What? Who? Why? How?
What I've hated about periods is I've been very, very lucky. I don't class myself as someone who has depression. I haven't had depression. But what I have when I'm due on my period is the the symptoms of depression, which is that I cannot think of a single reason to be happy. Mm-hmm. I count through all of my blessings, you know, my mum's alive, my dad's alive. I've got some money in the bank. I've got the fact the dog's there in the garden, there's bees on this flower. And then suddenly, you know, two or three days before, just grayness, like an inside out of the world. There is no reason. There is no reason to be alive. Nothing matters. There's just human pain everywhere. And that feeling is so scary, and because it feels so not conscious, it's not caused by an event. It's not caused by, and that's what I've hated, is it feels my body gave me a drug to go be really sad. And you do have to go out. I still have to do gigs. I still have to talk to people. You have to function in the world. And I've hated that cycle so much. And actually the relief of being pregnant with my first pregnancy, I kept saying to people, it's like an antidepressant, like something really horrible happened to my extended family while I was pregnant. And I actually questioned, am I a psychopath? Because I'm coping with this really well. And someone said, oh, it's because you're pregnant. You're full of, you know, estrogen and hormones and the elastic hormones. And also I just had 9 months off. And then actually you get a few months off afterwards as well. The ups and downs, the peaks and troughs. So actually it's that constant, you know, they say the boring success. That's being pregnant.
Yeah.
It's not the peaks and troughs. Oh, and also I think they're discovering so much more now about how hormones affect things like anxiety and ADHD. And so, it's just a horrible cycle. So in some ways, and I know that the process itself can be really, you know, it's another massive hormonal shift.
Yeah.
But I will not be sad not to menstruate anymore.
It's the best thing. It's the best thing. And sometimes I think when you start thinking about how much money you spent on sanitary protection and how you spend 30 years with a bloody mattress.
Yeah.
And all those horrible brown stains.
Yeah. Just like, just always on trousers. I, for years and years, couldn't afford. I was a toilet paper stuffer for years and years and years, which gives you even more fear about bleeding through.
Yeah. And was that for overspill or was that all of it?
No, just because it was too expensive. I mean, so expensive. That thing of like, £4. I mean, it's that or lunch, or my sister used to steal them from other people's houses, stealing a couple of pads or whatever, wherever we went. Now I have the period pants, which are a big financial investment at the beginning, but you wash them. Yeah.
They sound brilliant though. I wish they existed.
They are brilliant. And all of the fears that people had, I mean, they don't smell. I mean, they don't even smell. Honestly, if you leave them for 6 weeks in the basket, I mean, I was like, you know, I'm a messy, scruffy person. That all of the things you worry that might happen, they don't. And yeah, a cold wash gets everything out. And yeah, and they do ones that last for 8 hours that you can wear overnight. So even if you're very heavy, you can buy it. So, amazing. But at the beginning, they are expensive compared to pads and stuff. But in the long run.
But when you get to that point, which I got to where my periods were insane and I couldn't get the train to work without bleeding through. Yeah. You know, I could get through a box of the big ones in a day and a half.
Fuck, okay.
I mean, it's just like, well, you can't sleep because you're up every, no amount of towels.
No.
You're up every like hour and a half, two hours. It's just fucking hideous.
It is hideous.
Anyway, they're gone now.
Yeah. So was that on the way to menopause that it started getting heavy? No, it's just interesting to know. Because I just think no one should have made you go anyway. You should have been in a hammock.
Yeah, but I also, I mean, this is really boring, but I also had fibroids and polyps, I ended up having.
Yeah, I had polyps and I didn't realise until I got tests for IVF that that's why we weren't conceiving. I didn't know. Because it's just one of those things that you don't know about and you don't find out.
You just, also you take it for granted. You either have really heavy or really painful periods. That's just life if you're a woman.
Yeah. Especially if it's always been that. I've always, ever since 12, I mean, every other period or something, you know, not just the diarrhea, but vomiting and fainting from pain. If I hadn't taken painkillers in time, and it's only when you speak to other women who did go and have a doctor say, that's not normal. They go, oh, I thought we were all just, you know, fainting in the park or the shopping centre.
Yeah, that's the thing. When you faint, you go to the doctor and they go, it's because you're vegetarian. I mean, literally happens to me. Eat some meat.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. And then when I finally found a gynaecologist, she said to me, that's not normal.
No.
anyway. Yes, okay. I really must ask you the questions I always ask. What's your emotional age?
15.
Why 15?
Because I'm halfway between adulthood and childhood. I'm not quite mature enough to function properly. I don't deal with stuff. We've got mice in our flat, you know, and I quite like them.
Yeah.
And I don't.
You need a cat.
I would love a cat. We have a dog called Mouse who's scared of the mice. So yeah, 15. I've got a debit card, can get public transport, I can function in lots of ways, but not, I don't think I've got true maturity yet.
One of the questions I was going to ask you is, at what point did you become an adult? But you haven't yet.
I think I'm on the cusp. I think I'm on the cusp of adulthood. And my husband has ADHD, so I'm being forced to be the adult in our relationship, which is edging me there against my will, because I was going to be the fun one. I was going to be the child that didn't have their name on any bills.
Damn, bad plan.
Yeah, bad plan.
Bad organisation. Yeah. You're probably the last person I should ask this question, because we'll be here all day, but give us a book recommendation.
Okay, I'm going to go for something I read recently. I read Penance by Eliza Clark, and I'm recommending that because you like true crime.
I've got it on the table over there. Should I read it next?
I really, Eliza Clark's really young. She's very dynamic, very sort of dynamic prose. Really, really readable book that sort of, is critiquing how we feel about true crime, why we go to it, what we're getting from it, where it's going. I think she herself changed how she felt about true crime as entertainment while she wrote the book.
Ah, interesting.
But if you love,
it hasn't spoiled true crime podcast for you.
Oh no, it hasn't. No, but it does make you be honest about what you're getting from it if it's entertainment and why. And it's a page turner, so it's not like you're not getting lectured. So that's one I've read recently that's really great.
Brilliant. What advice would you give younger women?
I would say that thing about not being too hard on yourself. I think it's very difficult advice to take. But
I don't think I would ever have taken any of the advice.
No. And we all think we're hard on ourselves because we're really shit, and it's really useful. And also, or sometimes I think people worry that if they don't, they'll do less or achieve less. But just so much of the hardship is like just looking really, who is it telling you you're terrible? And I know that there is criticism in the world, but a lot of it is you. So it's like, if you could just ease off occasionally, because the men aren't doing that to themselves in the same way.
That's really true.
And it is sad that you can't just go like, just fine, forgive yourself, fuck it.
Do you do that though? Do you forgive yourself or do you carry it around?
I think I do forgive myself much more. I try to, and I try to be content with, I'm absolutely not a perfectionist. I say a bad gig would be a prime example. A bad gig feels really bad. You know, people came out to enjoy themselves and you didn't quite do it and you're better than you were, or they think you are. But they also said, then you have to go, I'm tired. I've did this. I mean, none of this takes away from the fact that the gig was bad, but come on now. Not all your gigs can be good. Like, I think you can reframe it slightly and go, you're a human being. You're on your period.
Yeah.
or whatever the reason is, you were hungry. You had, someone said something before you went on Twitter and it was in your head, just for whatever reason going, you didn't do it on purpose. Everyone's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's your old bird role model?
Well, there's women who aren't that much older than me.
That's
in
all right,
comedy. Well, actually, I'll say Jo Brand. And the reason is that when women are quite ubiquitous, we take them for granted. Jo Brand.
Like Victoria Wood would be a case in point, wouldn't she?
Yes. So, you know, and also with those women, that they're anomalies. I get asked a lot about how there used to be no women in comedy, and there were always women in comedy. There was no space for women in comedy. There were always women gigging. There were always women stand-ups. There were very few who made it through to TV. So they get to go, there was one, Jo Brand, or there's one, Victoria Wood and Jo Brand, or Jenny Eclair. Like, they get this on one hand. Jo Brand had children in her 40s, which I didn't know until she came on a show when I was pregnant with my first. And I love it, especially when their children are now adults. Because you have this fear that you'll be so old and decrepit. And actually, and Jo Brand, you know, she's just steadily maintained not only her work consistency and how good she is, but she's wonderful to work with us and she's happy to be there. Some of the men are really grumpy. They're really grumpy. They're so over it. They don't want to be there anymore. They actually shouldn't be taking up those spaces. And Jo Brand does her writing, improvises, excited to meet new comics. Everyone who meets her is so amazed that she like even cares who they are. It's actually quite a political with a small p way to act.
Yeah.
And so her work is really good. She is really wonderful. And I think it's really easy to take someone for granted and what they represent. The fact that she's always been there for women who want to go into comedy.
But interesting as well that she doesn't feel like she's too big and important.
Yes. But she has a story about doing a corporate where Joe Brand also has never, men tried to shut her up when she did jokes that were anti-men, very funny jokes. And the whole, so she was told not to talk about her periods. She had a routine that we loved so much on Through the Cake Hole about sitting on a white sofa, a neighbour's white sofa with her period. And that's the joke. It's like this horrible neighbour with their white sofa. Hearing that as a teenager on a video Through the Cake Hole again and again with my sister Cheryl was probably a big part of me having no shame about talking about my period or when I did bleed on things. My mum didn't tell me you might bleed on things. Joe Brand did.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
And she told me without shame or embarrassment. And she had like a man-hating style of comedy, which she still sometimes, I mean, she does still times do, but the world tried to tell her to stop doing it or that women were only funny if they were picking on men. Men were so defensive to her. She had a corporate in recent years where a man whispered to her on stage, I never knew you were such a cunt. And he said it so it wasn't on the microphone and no one else heard that he tried to humiliate her and she into the microphone told everyone what he'd just said.
Good for her.
I know. So I think she's like hugely brave and probably because she's been around for a long time, we don't notice all the
totally
time.
Take it for granted. Good point. What's your superpower?
I've got a good memory. I've got a very good memory.
Need it.
Yes. And I think stand-up really trains you. People said about getting pregnant, having mummy brain and stuff. And I think because my job involves so many words in such an order, I mean, I do write them on my hand, as you can see.
Yeah, I can see, yeah.
But then I kind of say
it. I think,
oh, I did remember it all. I did say it. So yeah, and it is a superpower because I know that with age, especially, and also reading books, if you read a lot, it all blends into one and you can't remember any characters and those kind of thing.
I misremember things. I actually keep a list of what I've read because I literally can't remember.
Yeah.
And especially if you read a lot of crime, and this is no diss on crime writers at all, you can't remember, I can't always remember which particular book, which murder was.
Yes, happened in. I find myself, travel W.H. Smith thinking, you know, I want a book for the journey. This one sounds fantastic. And like 11 pages in, oh, I read it. Yeah. So I think I've read all of the Leanne Moriarty's three times. So I keep reading the back and thinking I haven't read it. And then starting going, it's the one with the pond. I have read this one. Yeah.
Last one. How many fucks did you give?
Oh, too many. I don't have that lovely, no. I really envy people who do. Catherine Ryan, really. And I've been her friend for a long time watching her. She must secretly give a fuck about something and she doesn't. She must care about what someone thinks. No, she doesn't. And it's really enviable.
That's a real superpower.
A real superpower. And it means that you get to have a nice life or a nicer life. And again, that's that thing about if you can choose to just let some of it go, we must, mustn't we?
Yeah, it's the learning. I'm better at it, but not yet.
I think if you're wired for people pleasing and that happens in childhood and it just doesn't go away.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank
it's
you so
fantastic.
Much. Thank you.
I'm sorry I couldn't deliver a cat. I've got no idea where he is.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also like my conversations with comedian Josie Long and Cariad Lloyd, Sarah and Cariad's Weirdo Book Club partner. You'll find a link to all of those things in the show notes. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like more of The Shift in your life, head over to theshiftwithsambaker.substack.com and sign up for weekly newsletters, podcast extras and more.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.